Okay, so let's summarize what we did last week. We're in the middle of chapter Zayin, Perek Zayin, the seventh chapter. And he's talking about Klipas Noga, so that middle clipper, right? Klipas Noga means that something that is permissible, something that is neutral, it's clipper because it's still something that hides godliness, but it's got some potential spark in it, potential kedusha that, or potential energy, chayas, that's able to be elevated to the level of Kedusha when you use it for a good thing. So he described what it was, and then he described about using it for Kedusha. So for example, when you have something that's complete Kedusha, like a mitzvah, that's just Kedusha from beginning to end. When you have something that's klipah, it remains klipah, but there's sparks in it that can be elevated. And that's like, for example, he used two examples from last week. One is eating meat and drinking wine. That was from Rabbah, who said that he's not able to properly understand the Torah or give a shir properly unless he's had his steak. That broadens his mind, so he ate it completely the shem shamayim, and therefore he elevated it. Same thing with a joke. We learned that Rabbah, before we give a shir, he would say a mulsa d'dichas, he would say something light, they would laugh. In other words, used it to broaden the minds of people in order to learn Torah better. He gave these two examples that we explained last week. These are all things that are... These are all things that are dangerous. These are all things that can really be used for inappropriate indulgence. But he gave the example. These are things that when you work, you're able to use them with Shem Shemayim for the sake of heaven, and then you elevate them. Okay, so that's... Sorry? It's potentially holy. In other words, it's got some light in it. It's got some open light in it that is affecting it, that it makes it elevatable.
So the shattering of the vessels
that put the spark sort of captured in the gashmias.
The spark wasn't actually holiness. It was potentially.
No, the spark is holy. But the thing is not holy. So what happens is you do two things. You sift out the good from the bad, and then the good you elevate even to a higher madrega. Spark is holy, but not as holy as a mitzvah. That's what he said. I'll just find you the words. The way he puts it over here in Tani is that it's something called toiv, it's good. And then when you extract it out, you elevate it to kedusha, in other words, to a much higher level of holiness. So it's really, it's a trapped spark of holiness, but not as holy as like a mitzvah is, as kedusha is. And then you upgrade it to a higher level when you extract it. So there's two parts to it. One is sifting out the good from the bad, in other words, leaving behind the actual klipah, which remains klipah, like the potential for indulgence, the using it for frivolity and things like that. And you extract the good part, you channel it, you extract the good potential out of it, and then you elevate it even higher because you use it for kedusha. You elevate it to a higher level of kedusha.
So it's not neutral. It's good.
The spark is neutral, but the klipah itself is called neutral. The whole thing, the package deal, is called neutral because it's not forbidden, because it has that potential, so therefore it's not considered yet. In its current state, so a piece of steak in its current state is neither kedusha, a piece of kosher steak, is neither kedusha nor klipa at the moment. It's called klipas noiga. Why? Because it's a klipa, it's a piece of meat which is like the rest of the world, which is hiding Hashem, but it's got in it a spark of kedusha, so the combination makes it a neutral thing. When you sift it out, you sift out the good part, then you elevate the good part to even a higher level. That's how we see. Okay. Now he flips it and he sees what happens when it doesn't happen. So let's have a look. Ah, right, you see that at the two dots. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines from the bottom if you're using the Tanya. Yeah, you got the page that says 22 on it, Lisa?
Yeah.
So you got the ah, yeah? It's like towards the end of the line. Ah, he says, Bishuhu bezoilele boser vesevoi yai. Someone who's a glutton who eats meat and guzzles wine, something like that. Right? Well, the person who likes to indulge.
Iberfres, my grandfather.
Sorry?
Iberfres,
yes, exactly, very good. And why does he do it? He does it lemalois tavois gufoi. Benafshe abamis. Just to fill his desires, of his bodily desires and his animal soul tendencies, right? Which is, as we know before from the very beginning of Tanya, Shubachinas Yisoyed Hamayim. We said before that the Nefesh HaBamis has the spiritual four elements of the world, fire, water, dust, and wind. So this one is the Yisoyed Hamayim, it's the water element, which water represents the idea of Taiva, of of pleasures. Marba Yisoidus Harayim Shabbat, from the four bad elements of the Nefesh Abamis. Shememenu Midas HaTaiva, which gives birth to the trait of Taiva, of greed, or lust, or indulgence. So what happens now? So when that happens, what happens? What happens is as follows. Now, before we go further, what happens, we have to understand what this is. So, the act of enjoyment, purely for the sake of enjoyment, without any purpose to it, in other words, just for the having a good time and pleasure, just for pleasure, is actually intrinsically an avera, actually. It's a hard one to know, hard one to keep, but it's an avera. Why? And it comes from different places in the Torah, different psukim. The most famous one is kadoshim to you. Right? There's a mitzvah in the Torah, kadoshim to you, to be holy. It says kadosh to you, be holy. What does that mean? Says the Gemara. It means kadesh atzmoy b'mutar loch. Sanctify yourselves with things that are actually permitted. Right? In other words, just because something is kosher doesn't mean eating it is okay. Right? That's the truth. So much so, this is not even chassidus. This is just regular Gemara, actually. Right? In other words, indulgence, even in something that is okay, is considered klipa. Proper klipa, like an aver almost. Right? Okay. Sefer HaChinuch says this, Sefer HaMitzvahs and Rambam says this. Some people learn it from the pasuk. We say in Shema, Lo yisasuru acharei levavchem v'acharei lechem, don't follow your eyes and your heart. Right? There's all psukim in the Torah that goes down. So what happens? So a person, what he's doing is, he's doing an avera, right? He's doing something wrong. In other words, when I say avera, I mean like this. He's doing something, the act of indulging that way is actually not klipas noiga. The act of indulgence is klipas atzmeis lagamri, complete klipa. Complete klipa. Mm-hmm. Right? Like in the three levels we spoke about last time. What he's doing it with is klipas noiga. Mm-hmm. Right? So what happens? So what happens is, he says, in al day zeh, through that, yoyred hachayis habasar ayayin shebekirboi. The life force of the meat and the wine, that's his example now, meat and wine, right? Goes down, descends, v'nichlal l'fi shah, and becomes incorporated temporarily, b'ra gomer, with real bad. Shebesholosh klipas atzmeis, of the three complete klipas. Why? What is that? So what happens is like this. When a person does any aveira, right? So let's take something, I saw this one of the commentaries of the Tanya, which is actually very, very, brings that out very clearly. Let's say someone eats on Yom Kippur, but eats kosher. Right?
It's worse than eating treff.
Is it?
I think that's what you said.
It's not saying worse.
Well, it's going down.
It's going down, yeah. You're downgrade. So when you eat treff, the treff itself is klipa. Correct. Complete klipa, right? We'll call it complete klipa, neutral klipa. Right? So okay. When you eat neutral klipa, but you're doing an aver with it, so let's say someone eats on Yom Kippur, right? Someone is, I'm talking about intentionally, not someone who's unwell or something, but he eats because he's breaking Yom Kippur, right? So that act is an act of complete klipa, right? Because that's a serious transgression of the Torah. I'm giving that example because it's easy to understand than the indulgence, which we don't look at as an aver normally, right? So it's an act of complete klipa. And who's fueling that act? Who's giving life to that experience? The neutral klipa. Sorry?
So you say kosher if you eat?
Sorry?
Kosher meat.
Right. So you're eating kosher meat on Yom Kippur. That experience, everything, right? So what you're doing is using something neutral to nourish a real klipa experience. Correct? So in Kabbalistic words, it's called Moisif Chayis Beklipa. So what you're doing is using something which is neutral to add fuel, to add Chayis, to add energy into real Klipa. Because you're strengthening the Klipa. Before you ate on Yom Kippur, the experience of eating Yom Kippur is a theoretical experience. It exists, everything exists, even theories exist. Right? It exists, but it exists on very minimal, but now you're giving it life. You're giving life to a real klipa experience using something which is neutral klipa.
Are you saying that
the kosher is neutral? Yeah. It's klipa, but it's neutral because it can be elevated. Mm-hmm. Like we learned last week, if you use it for kedusha, it's elevated. Mm-hmm. Or the sparks elevate, whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. Here you're using neutral klipa to fuel and to energize a real klipa experience. So therefore, the energy of a neutral klipa descends temporarily, and we'll see why it's temporary, right, into the world of real klipa. So you've dragged the neutral klipa into the real klipa.
So you might as well give up, because whatever you're doing is bad and wrong. And...
Very good question. No, not at all. Not at all, not at all, not at all. There's still, first of all, there's still a huge difference between doing an avera and eating for pleasure. There's a huge difference, right? And avera is complete klipa, distinct from Hashem, etc. And the point of this Tanya, this is the point of the whole Tanya, really. We said that. So we talk in extremes, and because that's ultimate truth. And then the idea is, in other words, like this. So if we learn a parak Tanya like this, right? And it's even one time, or even temporarily, or even just a little bit, it moves us to move away from being a completely hedonistic person, we've succeeded. Hashem knows who He created, by the way. Right? He knows He created us with all our indulgences and all our pursuits of pleasure and so on and so forth. Right?
But Rabbi, the thing that I'm taking from this, I'm sorry to interrupt, this feels very strong for me, is our whole society about indulgence, and I'm not talking about food. I'm talking about how and where we live and what we do and how we dress and whatever, is so mainstream now that it's very hard to see that.
Correct.
Even more hard than like trade food, which you know, or eating without a blessing.
That's why.
When you live with all the stuff that's become,
it's getting worse.
Normal. Yeah. That's normal.
Right. And I wanted to say, you see, the application of, yeah, no, that's 100%. That's why it's so important to learn this, right? Now, everyone has to know also where they're up to. We all are on a journey, a spiritual journey. So I'll give you an example of something that also doesn't apply to us, but it gives a perspective a little bit, right? So the old Hasidim of yesteryear, right? There was a process, because of what it says here in Tanya, there was a process that they would go through called iskafia. Iskafia means that they would consciously curb and prevent themselves from overindulging to the point where, I mean, this would be so foreign to us, but this is what used to happen. But I'm going to tell you a story in a second, right? That when they were in yeshiva, like the Bochrim and the Babish, they were known to be like the real appliers of this Tanya, right? Of this idea. The Bochrim and the Sil Babish, who were, you know, educated by the Rebbe Rashab, but they were on a very high level, they davened for, and they were like, a lot of them were like really, you know, into this. And the demands on them were very, very, very powerful, that they shouldn't have any interest in like pursuing pleasure in any way, and so on and so forth. So it was known, like in the yeshiva of Lubavitch, when they would serve a very simple dinner and a bocher got on his plate two meat cutlets, they would eat one and leave the other one, and not eat the other one. Just to eat one, I'll survive on that, that's good enough, I don't have to eat the second one. Okay. And there were great Hasidim who came out like that, right? So one of them became later a mashpia, he became the mentor in a yeshiva of France. His name was Reb Nissen Nemenov. Nissen Nemenov was a very, very big chassid. In fact, it's reported that the previous Rebbe once said about him that he actually is a Beinoni of Tanya. So he was a complete control, lucky, right? To reach the Beinoni of Tanya is a very, very difficult thing. Okay. But him, his world, he once said, because of the food in Brumois was notorious. It wasn't very good. The food they gave, the general, the kitchen there wasn't very up to standard. And the Bocher once complained, he says, "Not what they complain about. They have bread, and not only that, even on the bread they can smear butter. So I mean, what do they want? Like it's like he thought it was five star. Anyway, so he, you know, it was after the war, and people now had moved to America, and it was a different society a little bit. And he went into Yechidus by the Rebbe, and the Rebbe told him that you have to understand that today is different. So the Rebbe was very clear. What does that mean? The concept of Iskafia still applies. Right?
In a new context,
in a new way. So for example, this idea of getting on your plate a normal meal and your main course and you get two cutlets, no, it's not for today to say I'm going to leave one cutlet. Eat what's on your plate and all good. He said, does that mean you shouldn't farbrain, you shouldn't talk about iskafia? Of course you should. But it might mean that they shouldn't indulge in things that are completely not necessary. That kind of thing, right? And I think the same thing applies to us. We all know where we're up to, and it could be even one time. Like, maybe we eat a little bit less ice cream. It's also good, you know what I'm saying? Like, if that's what it means. Or some of us maybe need to fix things that are other, you know, because if he's talking, people, you know, he's assuming that, he talks about, you know, eating meat and wine, assuming that kashrus everyone's keeping, and then and they're davening properly, they're keeping the whole Shulchan Aruch. Another problem is how much they're indulging in meat. Okay, so so that's the issue. Someone else might be a different issue. It might be an issue that's actually really a halachic issue, which is, but the idea is that we need to work. We need to discipline ourselves. That is the idea. And if we take that out of Tanya, that's really what we're supposed to take out. So he's talking in absolute terms. That's true. The truth is, the absolute terms, everything we do, everything we engage in, needs to be l'shem shamayim. There's a very interesting comment from the Tzemach Tzedek, by the way, which is an interesting one. And maybe even that is something to aspire to. Which I was going to bring up later, but I'll bring up now since we're talking about it. How about if a person doesn't indulge? Let's say a person eats. This is an interesting concept, this, right? So he's not indulging. He's not like being just following his pleasures. But let's say a person eats, but very healthily. He eats like just what he needs to eat. Portion control, healthy things, l'tzorech kiyum gufay, for the purpose of existing, person being healthy. But he doesn't have any particular intention of the shem shamayim. It's not like he's doing it for Hashem, but he's not indulging either, right? That's an interesting category. So the Tzemach Tzedek says, in such a case, what happens is that the klipa doesn't descend into complete klipa, but it's not elevated either. So it remains klipas noy, that's what it does. In other words, the food just remains the same klipa that you are. In other words, so that's not bad, right? Even to prevent the klipa going down to proper klipa is also a good thing.
I don't need to be religious, I just need to be a good person.
Right, but I'm saying, but
it's the same thing.
Yeah, but the only thing is that's normally done in a very different context. That's a person who is not even interested in doing mitzvahs. Often people say that, right? I'm talking about a person that is observant. But nevertheless, it's not on the madrega that he eats the shem shamayim. He eats mamash with the intention of eating shem shamayim. But he is disciplined. He eats at least, he prevents himself from indulging. Can he say that he eats mamash because the only purpose why he's eating is I mean, yeah, no, he likes the portion. It's not like he, right? But at least it's not for indulgence, so then the klipa doesn't at least go down to the klipa, the complete klipa, but it remains in klipa. No, that's it. Yeah, no, he said that even if a person eats for health but it's not the shame shamayim, it's still klipa. That's his point. Now, that's when he was defining what klipas noiga is.
So is that when the health becomes an indulgence?
No. Even if a person just eats healthily,
right.
So the food is still klipa. Klipa, because not klipa can only be when you do it for Hashem's sake. Mm-hmm. Let's say a person is mamish, very disciplined, right? Only eats enough to survive. Properly healthy, which if we all ate like that would be great. It would probably be a really healthy way of living, right? But he's not particularly focused on Shem Shamayim. So he's not indulging, he's not doing anything bad. As long as something is not Shem Shamayim for the sake of Hashem, it's not Kedusha.
Yeah.
If it's not Kedusha, then it's Klippa. But what the Tzemach Tzedek is saying is, in such a case, it remains Klippas Noyeg. It doesn't go down to Klippas, to proper Klippa. Whereas someone indulges, it goes down to proper Klippa. So that's a very important point you made. So the intention of learning this is not to give up. On the contrary, it's to take one step towards the journey. We might be a million steps away from it, but it doesn't matter. It's having a mindset and aspiring a little bit less to be involved in worldliness, a little bit more to be involved in Hashem. That's the idea. And to keep on growing in that direction. But yeah, it is a fundamental principle of Chassidus. There's no question. The modern day indulgence in Gashmias in general and the materialism that is going on is completely at odds with everything that we're learning. There's no question about that. That is absolute. Yeah. That doesn't mean that we're on the level that we should be like Reb Zusha Vanipoli, who lives in a shack and has hardly what to eat and hardly what to wear, and he's fine with it because he doesn't know anything else. He just knows Hashem. He's just, like Rav Zusha said, nothing ever bad happened to him because he's just happy he can do a mitzvah and put on tefillin and keep Shabbos. That doesn't mean that's what it means for us, right?
It's the purpose,
and also everyone has to know themselves. I mean, you know, we live in a society where to live basic comfort is a normal thing. It's not necessarily bad. Nor are we on the level to think that we cannot do that. Right? But it is, every person in their own way has to put it into context and know what it's for, what the purpose is, and everyone knows, everyone can be honest with themselves when it becomes an indulgence thing and it becomes that you have to have, you know, the best brand because someone else has it, or you just spend all your time with pleasures and that's the whole purpose of life, then it becomes a problem. So yeah, it's talking in absolute terms, but every person has to know where they fit in and take one step towards that absoluteness. That's the idea. So what are we saying? So therefore, when a person does that, so again, a person indulges, eats the food just for pleasure, right? So he takes the neutral kedusha and brings it down to the world of klipah, right? Not only that, he says, "V'gufoy nasel and levushim rakover." Besides that, you've now dragged down the klipas noiga into proper klipah and energized proper klipah. That proper klipah that you just energized is within you. It's the food you've eaten, right? It's the experience you've had. It's now you. So your body has now become a vehicle, a merkava for that proper klipah, right? Now, when he says that, I want to just, every word of Tanya is very well thought out. He doesn't only say that your body has become a dwelling place for that klipah. He says your body has become a chariot for that klipah, merkava. That word merkava, right? This is a very important point, actually. That word merkava means a chariot, and normally it's used. Let me tell you how it's used in the area of Kedusha, first of all, right? So we say, for example, that Avram, the Avos and the Imois, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarif, Leah, and so on, they were merkavah to godliness. They were chariots to godliness. What does that mean? A chariot in Chassidus, when you word the word merkavah, is a symbol of complete surrender, meaning like Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, their whole being became completely surrendered to Hashem, Moshe Rabbeinu, Tzadikim, and so on, right? Which means that their entire being was just to do the will of Hashem, right? In other words, they were driven by Hashem's will. That's what I mean. That's when a person becomes such a high madrega that their whole being becomes like a chariot. What's a chariot? A chariot doesn't have their own will. A chariot goes where the rider tells it to go, right? So that's what it is. Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and the Omos, the Imois, were at such a level that they were just a chariot of Hashem. Whatever Hashem told them to do, that's what they do, right? Here he's saying, what happens is, when you indulge that way, your goof uses the same expression. Your goof becomes a merkava to klipa, right? What does that mean? It highlights a very, very important thing. This is this is an area in life where you either go down or up. Which means the more you indulge, the more you become a servant of that indulgence. Right? And you become bottled, you become surrendered almost, right? And that's why it's so hard to break away from it. People who become very obsessed with indulgence and gashmias and materialism and pleasure and things like that become a merkavah. Your goof, your body becomes a merkavah to it. It becomes hard to move away from it. It becomes driven by it, right? Almost that people perceive it to be an absolute need, that they can't live with that, right? That's why it's so important sort of to break that cycle. Anyway, okay. So that's what happens when we use the klipas noiga for the wrong thing. Now he says, lefi shah, it's only temporary. Why is it only temporary? So here's an interesting thing. Again, using his example of meat and wine. So the meat and wine that you took, and you took the chayus, you took the energy from it, and you brought it down to the level of proper klipa, right? So it's not a permanent state. Why is it not a permanent state? Because intrinsically, that meat and wine remains a permissible thing. You just use it for the wrong reason. So with tshuva, it can be reversed. Let's have a look. It's like this. The fish shot's only temporary. Ada sheri yoshuv ha'odom v'yachsul ha'baris ha'maturasa. Until the person returns and does tshuva, and he returns to Hashem's service and his Torah. Right? In other words, if a person lives a life and he's being indulgent, not doing bad things, he's just doing neutral things, but for the wrong reason. So he's used the neutral klipah for proper klipah purposes. And then the person does tshuva, right? What does he mean does tshuva? That means he returns to a new pathway that instead of being sunken into the obsession of indulgence, of the pleasures of the world, even permissible pleasures, he now reaches a level or he's on the path to serving Hashem in a way that everything that he's doing is for the purpose of Hashem. What happens is, he now re-elevates that power, that energy of the meat and the wine, which is talking about here, which was brought down and downgraded to a level of proper klipa, he re-elevates it to the realm of Kedusha. That's an amazing idea. So it's not like if we were older and we think, okay, well, I live my life pretty much indulgent, so now I'm lost, forget about this. No, it's not. The more we move ourselves towards curbing that desire and curbing that indulgence and only focusing and making Hashem the center of our lives, the more we're able to elevate that previously sunken, permissible klipa, neutral klipa, into a realm of a proper klipa, we're able to redirect it and re-elevate it to the realms of Kedusha. Why? So that's the person who does tshuva comes high. But now we're just talking about the energy of the... He doesn't say that, but that's true with the person. That is true, and we'll see in a second. Why is that? Because ki lefi shehoya psar heter v'yayin kosher. Because since the meat was kosher, and the wine was kosher. It's called, now, in Hebrew, when something is kosher, or something... I mean, kosher is a term of the actual thing. When something is permissible, the word we use is mutar, right? There's a very important thing to explain that. In Hebrew we have mutar and asur, right? So mutar and asur is a term which we use throughout halacha. Mutar means it's permissible, asur means forbidden. That's how we normally use it, right? So if you tell me, can I reheat cold water on Shabbos in any way? No, the word answer is asur. Can you put a dry challah on a Shabbos platter to rewarm it on Shabbos? The answer is mutter. It's okay. You could. I'm not giving a halacha shiur on Shabbos, but I'm just using an example, right? So if I use the terminology, and every time most times people would ask me a shayla, the answer would be mutter or asr. That's right. That's it. But what's interesting is if you have a look at the etymology of the word mutter and asr, it has a different meaning, right? Mutter means lahatir, like when you untie a knot, it's lahatir to release. Right. When Hashem takes a person out of jail, it's called matir asurim. He's releasing matir asur. The word asur means to be chained. Right. The translation of the word we use in the context of being forbidden, and mutar means permissible. But actually, the word mutar means it's released. It's not bound, and asur means it's bound. In prison. A jail is called Beit Asurim in Hebrew. A house of confinement. It's confined. It's right. So why is something treif called Asur to eat? Because it's imprisoned by klipa to the point that it's not releasable, it's not elevatable. That's why something is Asur. Why is something kosher called Mutar? Because it's klipa, but you can release it from klipa. You can elevate it to Dusha, as we've just been learning. Correct? Okay. So now, because you indulge in something mutar, that thing remains mutar. So go back to the easy example. When you eat kosher things on Yom Kippur, yes, your experience was asr, but the food that's energizing the klipa remains mutar. You've downgraded it, you've schlepped it in to give energy to klipa, but it remains a mutar energy, remains a mutar process. And it's internally mutar. Which means with the right shuvah, if I return to serve Hashem properly, I can release it back. Right? And he says, what was the lashon here? So he says, that's right. L'kachi choylim lachzur v'lalois imoy b'shuvah l'avadis Hashem. That's why I can return and be elevated with him when he returns to the service of Hashem. Shezeu lashon heter u'mutar. That's what heter, the word heter and mutar means. It's not bound up, the osur, and imprisoned bidei hachitzonim in the hands of the klippas, in such a way that it's not able to re-elevate itself to Hashem. Right? He does say, however, that what happens is Rak sharushimu mimenu nishar beguf. But what does happen is as follows, and the Istart and Tanya, where it gets Kabbalistically technical here. He says what happens is that...
because the rest of it is not technical.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's like very technical. What he says is... He says like this, he says what happens is, so basically he outlines the process. So when someone indulged in pleasure, let's say eating or whatever, let's say the area is eating, right? And even if it was a mutar experience, but he did it for the wrong reason, he downgrades the chayas, the energy of the meat and the wine to proper klippah. When he does tshuva, he reverses the cycle and it re-elevates. However, because for a time being, he says, this is what his next line is, because for a time being, his body was a vehicle and a merkava to the klippah, so something, an impression of the klippah gets left in the body, and Val Cain, you'll see what I mean by technical. Val Cain, Sorech l'chibut ha-kever k'moshis boy l'kama. And that's why when a person passes away, in order to cleanse that remaining stain, a person needs to go through a process called chibut ha-kever. So what that means is, it's like a shaking up of the grave. What it means is, it's a thing that he describes later in Tanya in more detail, but just to give you a little bit of insight, so there are certain things that happen to a person after passing away, which are there just to cleanse things that were left over, residue of things that a person needs cleansing from, right? We're not talking about real punishment like perjury or whatever it's called, Gehenna, and things like that. We're talking about things that were mutar and he did tshuva for it, but an impression was left because it's actually a very good thing for the person, a painful thing, but nevertheless a good thing. Just interesting, just to mention, like the... you know, there's a thing, they don't do it over here so much or in other countries, but in Yerushalayim they do it. You know, there's a thing when you bury someone, there's certain things that happen after death. Again, that's why I said it's very technical. I'm not an expert on these things, but I'll just give you a little bit of insight. So in Yerushalayim, for example, in Israel in general, you know, they don't bury people in coffins, you know that? They put it on the ground. Sorry?
In a sheet,
on the ground. You know why? Because it hastens the decomposition. And that's a good thing. Why is a good thing? Most people decompose, except for great tzaddikim that don't, which, by the way, is a phenomenal thing. That there's like proper evidence of this, right? That they sometimes have to move graves of tzaddikim and they open it up, and the person is years later complete. It's an amazing thing, but it doesn't happen to most people. Most right? But actually, it's a good thing. Although it's not such a comfortable thing for the neshama when that happens, but it's a tikkun. Actually, rectifies things that needed rectification. And that's something to do with what he's saying via chibut akever, and there's some things that happen afterwards, like where that happens, and it's a final cleansing for the residue of stuff that was left over. So most of it is taking place with the tshuva that we do, and we re-elevate the chayas from the proper klippah to the direction of dusha, but the impression that's left needs chibut akever. Incidentally, what I just said about putting on the ground, what they do the rest of it, they do it in other places as well, but in the rest of what they do is, for example, here or in South Africa, they drill holes, you know that, underneath the coffin. To make it more accessible to the earth. I think it's illegal to bury someone on the ground. You have to have a coffin.
All coffins have holes?
Jewish ones, yeah. And underneath, they drill holes. Not exactly how many holes, but they drill holes. The idea is just to at least have this idea a little bit to connect it to the earth. Yeah, go on.
They're just tiny holes. Yeah.
Are you looking?
No, I don't know if it's a completely different question, but what if you don't know anything about this? What if you really, I can think of anything that I don't know about this. So what? So you don't have a chance to improve yourself. What happens to you?
Okay.
Not everybody...
That's a very, very, very good question. So the answer is like this. There is a concept in the Gemara, right? Called Tinok Shenishba Labeinu Akum, a child that was captured among the non-Jews. Right, that's the famous example. So let's go back in times where the whole community was very literate and knew everything and all that. So you have a thing, let's say a child was kidnapped. So as a Jewish child, he grew up, knows nothing, right? So the answer to that is that obviously if that's something that Hashem orchestrated, so it's for a reason, right? So there's two issues here. One issue is, why did that happen? Meaning, why did Hashem allow that to happen? Right? And saying, well, what's the story with this person there? So in terms of being accountable to Hashem, the person is completely not accountable. In other words, in terms of the various atonements and punishments and cleansing processes that a person has to go through, that person doesn't have to go through any of that. because he's not guilty. He did no better, right? It's not a choice. That person didn't not keep Shabbos because he's got a choice. He didn't even know Shabbos existed, right? In the extreme, I'm talking about, right? So he's not held accountable for any of the things he didn't do, or any of the things he did do, which are wrong. He's not held accountable for any of that. Even forget about klipas noiga, even proper klipa, even any of the treif that he ate, any of the Shabbos that he broke, nothing. He's not held accountable for that, right? However, is it a mitzvah to go and try and bring that person back to Yiddishkeit? Of course. Because while the person is out of trouble, the purpose of life is not just to stay out of trouble. The purpose is to connect to Hashem. So the idea of bringing that person, trying to find the captured child, and bring them into the fold of Yiddishkeit, so to speak, is to give that person a tremendous gift. Is to say, listen, you're not held accountable for any of this, but you still don't have the opportunity of doing the mitzvah. The benefit of the mitzvah you don't get because you weren't given that opportunity, but you don't have it, right? So you don't get that connection with benching a lulav or making kiddush or giving tzedakah, whatever, right? And that's why the person's not held accountable, but is still missing out. So you still have to go bring them back. Now, there's a very, very fascinating discussion today. The consensus, the halachic consensus, because it has a ramification of the halacha also. The halachic consensus today is that all yidden who are far from Torah and mitzvahs are in that category. All Jews that are in that are far from Yiddishkeit are in that category. Which, by the way, is the founding principle of the outreach movement. Because actually, if a Jew willfully goes against Hashem, you're not supposed to give him a place, you're supposed to shun him. Right?
I was going to ask you the question. If you look at all the Jews who are alive in the world today, how many of them have got this knowledge?
No, don't.
So
we have to look at that. It's not their fault at all. However, we're doing them a big gift if we give them the knowledge. So okay. it's all games. All right?
It's a very calm
religion.
But you're so many of
them don't
know it.
Sorry?
I don't know.
No, so how about people? No, so what does that mean? So what does that mean? Does it mean like, so even when it comes to things, because there are certain halachas, I mean, I'll be blunt, right? If you want to go to pure halacha, for example, old mainstream halacha, which is eternal, I mean, halacha is eternal, we're not changing the Torah here, right? Someone who's mechalal Shabbos in public, someone who doesn't keep desecrate Shabbos in public, you really can't count them for a minion. Can't count them for a minion,
yeah.
Right? Every Chabaras in the world counts people that for a minyan, right? I made plenty of minyanim where there's only three people that keep Shabbos in the minyan. So why do I do that? Because this is the idea. Because we say that everyone is the category of... Because when the halacha says that someone who desecrates Shabbos is not counted for a minyan, what it's referring to is someone who knows about Shabbos. And let me add, knows about Shabbos means not just he knows that Shabbos exists and he knows that some archaic Jews keep Shabbos, but it's for the shtetl and not for him. Right? That's not what knowing about Shabbos means. Right? Knowing about Shabbos means that you understand Shabbos, you understand the severity of Shabbos, you understand what Shabbos means, you understand why it's so important, right? That doesn't apply today. In fact, the Chazon Ish, who actually wasn't from the Hasidic persuasion at all, was very known to teach this. And he said, he was once asked about, but Shulchan Aruch says, I mean, you look at Shulchan Aruch, but it says, okay, but if you educate the person and they still don't listen, then surely they transfer into the category, now they do know. Now, so they shouldn't be, right? Which would make teaching people dangerous then, right?
Yeah.
Right. So he said, no, ain on the bekim but the chachos. We are not expert in teaching today. If we reprimanded the person that didn't listen, it's our fault, not theirs. We should have to do a better job in educating them, and inspiring them, and bringing them close, right? So that's, I don't know, it's not exactly connected there, but that's now, the question is also why, you know, it's no fault of their own, but why, like, so there's a, we don't know. So everything works on many, on multiple layers. So for us, we just know what the fact is. The fact is, these are Jews who don't know better. They have the category of status of a Tinnish Rishpa. We need to try our best to bring them back to Yiddishkeit, because we're giving them, every bit of Yiddishkeit we bring them back to, we're just doing them a favor and giving them a tremendous gift. But we don't hold them. We completely embrace them, right? Because they are in the category of the child that was captured. Now, Then there's another thing. Why did it happen? And what's the purpose of these Jews? Without, let's say, I mean, there are plenty of Jews that will live a whole lifetime and will never know anything about Yiddish guy, right? So we don't know. Like, but I can tell you an interesting thing. There was this concept, I think the Mittler Rebbe, if I'm not mistaken. There was a period in under Russia, in Russian Jewry, going back 200 years ago or something, that the Tsar made this unbelievable, terrible decree. They, I don't know what it's called in the world, but in Hasidic history, it's called the Cantonists. And these were terrible, terrible things. The Russians would come around. They were religious. The Tsar was, I think, Greek, Russian Orthodox or something, whatever they were. And they would have a quota in each town. They would capture little kids, 7, 8. Like they came to the community, you got to give up 7 kids or 8 kids, whatever the case is. And they'll take them to the army for 25 years. The idea wasn't just a military exercise. The idea was to baptize them and to make them go Yiddish guy, right? And these guys came out after 25 years. So I guess some of them succumbed, but many of them actually, even as children, had tremendous mesiras nefesh. But they came out 25 years later and they were damaged people, completely damaged people. And they were ignorant, completely ignorant. Some of them still are on the Yiddishkeit, amazingly so. But there were special shuls that were just for the Cantonists, because they were socially awkward. They were a complete mess when they came out after 25 years, right? But they didn't keep a lot of Yiddishkeit. They were very, very, they were frum, but they weren't, didn't keep all the mitzvahs. They didn't know what to do. And they were captured when they were 7 or 8 years old, right? And I think the Mittler Rebbe, I think, once said a whole mimer to understand, like, what's going on here? Like, what was this all about? And he gave a little bit of insight. I think there were a couple of different things. He says part of it was a tikkun for the first Beis HaMikdash. These were the neshamas that came from the first Beis HaMikdash. That what happened was, in the first Beis HaMikdash, Yidden were very knowledgeable, and they kept the mitzvahs, but they got caught in a bizarre yetzahara of avodah zarah, of idol worship, right? Like, there were people who could have been eating kosher, and then they wouldn't bow down to an idol. It was a crazy obsession in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, right? And these neshamas that came in the canton, as he says, explain. I mean, we can never explain things. We can only deal with what we have. But Big Tzaddikim, and if I'm not mistaken, one of the things he explained is that some of these were tikkun, were a rectification for that generation. These are people that didn't keep much mitzvahs, but they gave up they're ready to give up their life for not renouncing their belief in Hashem. These were kids who refused to convert. And some of them got beaten, and it was like a terrible, terrible thing. But apparently what they did was they made a tikkun of. So we don't know. We don't know the value of people's mitzvahs. We don't know what has to be fixed in the world. We don't know what the purpose is. There could be a Yid who lives somewhere in a far-flung corner, and he's, maybe even if we're not successful with him, maybe his tachlis was to eat matzah once on Pesach. We don't know. But that's not our business. Our business is to bring is to keep all the mitzvahs and to bring as many Yid into keeping mitzvahs as possible. That's the concept, right? And if I don't know if I answered your question, but that was the idea. But going back to those of us who are learning Tanya and do understand what's going on, right? So he says that the impression, so you can do tshuva with klipas noga, you can reverse the trend. He says the same thing happens, by the way, it's not only eating. He gives over here, V'chein ha'chai, shem ha'tipa, zera, shiotzim, and ha'betai, v'abamis, shlokidish atzim, v'shas tashvish, shem ishtai, tahira. He says, he talks about even sexual relationships, when they happen, even in a permissible sense, they have to be, everything has to be a mitzvah. In pure Yiddishkeit, everything's a mitzvah. So even when a person is engaging, not in a forbidden act, but with a permissible act, he gives the example of a person living with his wife. She is clean, she's tahira, she's wet to mikveh, it's the right time of the month, he's okay, she's okay. But it was a purely pleasurable thing, which is a hard thing, by the way, because it's supposed to be a pleasurable thing, right? But nevertheless, there was no purpose in it, there was no intent there. Also, same idea that initially, though, that it's an act of klipas noiga, it could be downgraded sometimes to proper klipah, but it can be reversed through the idea of tshuva. Now, it says, that's when we talk about things that are mutar, because mutar means they're not bound up with klipah. And now, how does tshuva work with things that are asur? Right? Here's a bigger problem. But when you talk about food, he's giving the example of food and sexual activity, right? So when you talk about food or forbidden relationships, there, not only the experience is proper klipah, but the tool is proper klipah. You don't use a mutar object. You use an asur object or an asur experience, right? Yeah? So that's a problem, because then the life force that you brought into yourself So a person takes a piece of chazer and he eats the chazer, right? That's a big problem now, because before he said the body became a vehicle to the klipa, the proper klipa, because you downgrade the klipa. However, the benefit was you can do tshuva and you can reverse it and you can re-elevate the klipa. Okay, a little bit of impression will be left in your body, for which after the person dies, I'll take care of it. But now he said, how about if a person eats or engages in activity, internalizes an activity, in other words, he brought it into himself, he brought something which is mamash klipa, which is a proper klipa. It's asur. Asur means it's imprisoned in klipa, cannot be elevated, which is why it's forbidden in the first place. Right? Things that are not kosher are called asur because the energy there is klipa, it's not elevatable. Because it's not elevatable, it's relegated to klipa and you can't do anything about it, right? So there he says, hey masurim ukshurim biad chitzonim lo'ilam. They are bound up in the world of the outside world, the klipa world. They cannot be elevated. Once they're there, it's there. You've messed it up. Ad ki yova yoma yuvalam with nesach, until the day comes where death will be followed up, where we'll be removed from the world. Okay, the pasuk says Mashiach comes, Hashem will remove the spirit of impurity from the world. So far it sounds terrible, which means like this: I can do an avera, which means I've now brought internalized real klipa. I can do tshuva. It'll help. It'll help to be forgiven. It'll help to be out of trouble. It'll help to be not going forward. But the klipa that I brought into me that I observed is there. I'm harboring klipa. I'm facilitating klipa in my body, kind of forever. However, ad oy, he says, either you're gonna have to wait till Mashiach comes, or achi yase tshuva gedoyla kol kach, unless you do such an unbelievable tshuva, where the Gemara tells us shazdoinos nasulei kazachias mamish, that the averus become like mitzvahs. Now, what does that mean? The Gemara says this. The Gemara says there's two levels of tshuva: tshuva out of fear, technical tshuva, or tshuva out of love, tshuva out of yearning, right? And the Gemara says that when you do a tshuva ma'av out of love, it's intense tshuva, that the averus become mitzvahs. Now, what does it mean that averus become mitzvahs? You have to understand. Obviously, you have to be very careful when we say this. An averu never becomes a mitzvah. An averu is something that is against the will of Hashem. That never becomes good. That remains not good. What he's talking about is the force, the chayas, the energy that was in the avera, can actually become an energy of a mitzvah. How so? What kind of tshuva are we talking about? So he says like this: she tshuva me'avo me'umko de'libo. It's a tshuva that comes from love, that comes from the depths of the heart. Be'avo rabba, with great love, chasheka and yearning, v'nefesh shakeka, and a yearning soul. Adovku be'yizbarach. Right? A person that does tshuva from an unbelievable place of yearning, he wants to come closer to Hashem. But someone nafshei laHashem ke'eretz hayefa v'tzia, and his soul is thirsting for Hashem, like a person thirsts in a barren and desert land. Now, listen carefully what he says there. A person comes to this incredible sense of yearning for Hashem, as if he's very far away, and that distance is burning up with a desire to reconnect. It's like he's in this barren foreign desert, and that's why he's so thirsty, he's just dying for a glass of water, right? How does that work? So he says like this, works like this. Liyois ki ad hei nohoi so nafshe beretzi v'tzal noves. That yearning, that intensity of the yearning comes because he was far away. You understand? In other words, like this. Person lands up in a world of klipa and sitra achra. He has sitra achra. Urechoyka me'or p'nei Hashem b'tachlis. So it's a person that now is engaged in lots of averus, and he suddenly takes stock of his life, and he realizes where he is. He realizes he's nowhere close to Hashem. He's very, very far from Hashem. And suddenly that feeling of being far from Hashem is the very catalyst that gives birth to an intense yearning to reconnect to Hashem. Right? And he says the next line, Ulazois tzomon nafshe b'yeser ois, and that's why his soul is even more thirsty. This person actually develops a yearning for Hashem that is stronger than a tzaddik's yearning for Hashem. Why? Because a tzaddik never tasted distance. He's familiar with Hashem. He loves Hashem. He yearns for Hashem every day. He wants to be close to Hashem. But he never has the yearning that comes that is born out of being far. It's a stronger distance. It's a stronger thing. So what happens? Chazal tell us, in a place where Baal Tshuva comes, a tzaddik can't even reach. Baal Tshuva is higher than a tzaddik. Why? Because a real Baal Tshuva, someone who does proper tshuva, can reach a yearning for Hashem that is greater than a tzaddik. that the tzaddik can't even reach. And the tshuva it says, Amru Chazal tell us doors like zochius that the averus become like mitzvah. What does that mean? In other words, what facilitated this yearning? The averu itself. So therefore, by doing such an intense tshuva, the energy of the avera, of the real klipa, in other words, can be channeled now to be elevated out of the tumma, out of the impurity of klipa. So that's how you get it back. That's how you elevate the spark. But avul tshuva shaloi ma'avazu. But if a person does tshuva, not out of that intense love, after tshuva nechoyna, even though it's a good tshuva, v'asher bisla, Hashem will forgive him, but you can't say it becomes like mitzvahs. And in that case, therefore it won't come out of the klipa world completely. He can be a good guy, but he's still keeping that klipa within him, and that klipa won't come out of klipa completely until Mashiach comes, until the impurity is removed from the world. Right? That's why in many, many, so I just want to mention this, right? In many, many, that's why these two things Chassidus go together. So like it's not, because it's not a bad thing. Sometimes in later on in Tanya and in other parts of Tanya and in Chassidus general, there are certain mamorim that you learn, particularly like around Elul time, where they appear to be incredibly sharp, right? The same embracing religion we've been talking about suddenly turns on us and becomes this like unbelievable. And it talks about the cheshbon ha-nefesh, like the reflection a person has to have during Elul. And it goes into great detail. Our person has to go into this reflection of how far he's become from Hashem and how distant he is and how much he's lost his way and the whole thing, right? What's the purpose? The purpose is not depression or negativity. The question is that the only way you can come to this kind of tshuva is a bit of bashing up a little bit. You gotta attack your animal soul a little bit for this, right? In other words, you gotta identify the distance that you've caused. Not to despair, on the contrary. To develop such a yearning and then realize that Hashem wants that yearning and treasures that yearning and actually will bring you to a place that's greater. Right? Now, of course, that doesn't mean that's not a recommendation to sin, obviously. Right? In fact, the Gemara says if a person says, I'm gonna sin in order to do tshuva, Hashem blocks the pathway of tshuva. Even though tshuva is always possible, but it'll make it much harder. But the idea is that once you identify the distance, this is essentially the idea of shofar, right? After the whole month of Elul, that's what shofar represents, right? The cry of the child, the cry of the, Baruch Shem Tov says, the cry of the prince coming home. It's a very deep yearning to Hashem. It represents a very deep cry of, I want to reconnect, right? After the whole month of Elul, where you make the cheshbon and you realize what we've done to the past year. Obviously, there's not an obsessive thought that we're supposed to have every day, all day. That's unhealthy. But there are times for tshuva. The Alter Rebbe says later, there are times, generally we have to tshuva Hashem only with simcha, there are times to feel guilty. There are times to feel uncomfortable. At night before you go to sleep for a few minutes, Erev Rosh Chodesh, particularly in Elul, right, that's the time we do tshuva. We don't do this every day. But there are times where a person has to reflect to the point of crying, to the point of saying, no, I feel far and I want to reconnect. Because then you reach a tshuva level of tshuva ma'ava, tshuva of love, and that brings a greater distance. That's another way to redirect the energy of the chayis from the klipa, even when it's proper klipa, even when it's not klipas noiga. So a klipas noiga, when it descends into klipa, that the regular tshuva can help for that. A klipas proper klipa, to reverse the trend, you need a very deep tshuva. That's what you say. All right, we'll stop there.
Thank you. Do we have a shiur next week, or will you be away on Tuesday?